Okay, restart. Good afternoon, everybody. First of all, thank you for joining us for this last seminar of the semester of the STAR interest group. And today we will be talking about the multi-object spectrograph. And we are really honored to have two speakers who are really complementing, have like a very complementary expertise in many ways. John is now a department chair of the New Mexico State University, and of course, like most of us know him to be the service scientist and a major mover of the Apogee 2 for many, many years. Monica Valerie is talking about so more on the DESI side. So Monica is now the Milky Way survey part of the DESI, the co-chair of the Milky Way survey part of DESI. And so John is working mostly on the chemistry part and the DIS, and Monica the expertise is on the dynamic part and the inner DIS and also the halo. So this is why they are really like complementing like each other quite well. Again, to just remind you that the main goal of this a series of seminar is to like encourage a discussion about the decades away and also like different facility that will be happening in the next decade or is ongoing. So the talk is meant to be short. It's like 15 to 20 like minutes, and then we will leave more time for discussion. With that, I will leave like give the stage to John and Monica.
So I'm going to go first. Okay, can you see that okay? So good, pretty small group. So I'll try to kind of go through this pretty quickly so maybe we can stimulate a little discussion. What Johansson asked me to talk about was whether I could point to any lessons learned from the Apogee survey that might apply towards doing things in the future. So that's what I'll try to talk about. It's good apropos time to talk about this because in case you weren't aware, the Sloan data release 17, the final data release from Apogee just came out yesterday. Won't spend too much time. So I guess the categories I want to talk about is lessons learned as far as science, lessons learned as far as analysis, and lessons learned maybe as far as personnel. Science, probably most of you guys are all familiar with this. It kind of goes without saying, I think, that chemistry across the galaxy has turned out to be an interesting thing. Impossible to kind of summarize the full range of results, but most people are familiar with this plot from Michael Hayden showing the changes in the alpha to Fe versus Fe to H diagram across different zones in the Milky Way. And so this has obviously stimulated a lot of development ideas about galaxy formation and migration of stars in the galaxies and stuff like this. And I think that Apogee has been useful, valuable in this respect, particularly working in the disk and in the near infrared, the ability to probe through the disk. Just a few other kind of key new, a few new plots and interesting results. So here's we're working on kind of summing up all of data released, all of the full Apogee plus Apogee 2 surveys. So we'll have updated figures like this. Here's the full survey, metallicity gradient, and metallicity distribution function in the disk of the Milky Way. And here is maybe a little bit less certain, the age gradient and age distribution function in the Milky Way. This one depends on carbon and nitrogen abundances, which might have some systematic uncertainties in different zones, but that's the sort of stuff we're working at. I want to highlight that, these multi-object surveys obviously have a lot of synergy with other kinds of surveys. So obviously, for example, Gaia. So here's the alpha to Fe plot now, color-coded by eccentricity, additional constraints on galaxy formation with a combination of chemistry and dynamics. Of course, there's been tremendous synergy with astroseismology, the ability for giants to turn masses into ages. And then to correlate that with chemistry, for example, C to N abundances to enable plots like the age gradients across the galaxy. And of course, there's synergy with other abundance surveys. The near infrared is good for working in the disk, but doesn't probe all the different element groups, maybe as well as some optical studies are. So there's a lot of potential there. what else? Moving along to individual element abundances. I think an interesting result that's come out is that even though you can measure lots of different elemental abundances, that to some level of precision, most of them can be predicted by just measuring a few abundances, in particular measuring the metallicity and the alpha abundance or the metallicity and the age. And so that is good. If you just care about the broad brush thing, it's less good if you wanted to use the power of individual abundances to probe individual star formation sites. And I think it's a little bit TBD to see whether this extends outside of the Milky Way disk, in particular in observations of nearby dwarf galaxies and remnants of those in the halo, whether there's interesting patterns in individual element abundances. And Apogee maybe doesn't have the final word on this because it's mostly probing these two different nucleosynthetic pathways and not so much neutron capture elements. But I meant to write down here, there's a value-added catalog coming out trying to push Apogee a little bit further into neutron capture elements. And so that'll be interesting. And even for surveys that that probe different abundance groups like GALA, there's some suggestions that even across multiple abundance groups, that they can be predicted, abundances can be predicted moderately well from a small subset of abundances. This does not say that this is true at high level precision, as Yuan Sen has worked on with David Weinberg. If you probe statistically down to look at individual element abundance variations, although they're challenging to measure correlated abundances on individual star basis, the statistics of a large sample allows you to derive covariances between deviations from the predicted abundances from a few elements to other elements. And so at the few percent level, there may be informative variations. And then all this kind of puts aside the fact that there are some stars that are chemically anomalous, second generation stars and globular clusters, and they have turned out to be interesting tracers. And so this sort of, in terms of towards the future, you know, it kind of factors into the question of what the desired precision is. It may be, if you're only working at the interested in science at the few percent level, that maybe high precision is not required to get a broad brush picture of what multiple element abundances are. But if you really want to push down into tracing small deviations, then surveys might require higher precision. So I'd say the precision may or higher precision may or may not be desired, depending on what type of thing you're trying to go after. Okay, moving along into sort of lessons learned from analysis. So probably goes without saying, but should be repeated over and over, that, you know, the derived parameters of abundances depend critically on our understanding of more fundamental stellar physics. And I've split it into three different categories, the stellar atmospheres, spectral synthesis, and atomic and molecular data. And I think that there's a lot of pathway towards improvements on these things in the next decade. Although there have been work on stellar atmospheres in 3D for the industrial applications of the large surveys, including Apogee, they're still mostly relying on 1D atmospheres. And so that may be a fundamental systematic limitation. I think that it's important to realize that perhaps because of the approximations being made in this fundamental physics, what you derive spectroscopically doesn't always match what other, perhaps more physical analysis tell you about the stellar parameters. So here's a plot, for example, that shows this for surface gravities for a subsample of Apogee stars, comparing the spectroscopic surface gravities to some other kind of reference surface gravity, in this case, surface gravities from astroseismology, in this case, astroseismology, in this case, from isochrones, and in the case of clusters, from direct measurements of distances and a fairly good understanding of the giant masses in clusters. And you can see that there are some systematic differences at a few tenths, and in this case, strong systematic as a function of metallicity. So, these systematic deviations exist? Do they exist because we're doing things in 1D or because there's limitations in how we're modeling the data? I think it's actually not incredibly well known, but a little bit more on that in a second. And you know, these deviations in spectroscopic analysis kind of lead to, I think, an important question for surveys to consider in the future, which is this question to calibrate or not to calibrate. The spectroscopic parameters are the ones that best match the spectra. But when you're measuring individual element abundances, do you want to use a more physical gravity in this case, or do you want to use the spectroscopic one? That's something that the Apogee team has gone back and forth on and I think not fully converged about. And again, looking towards the future, I think it's an interesting question and discussion item to talk about the future of these fundamental analysis codes, the atmospheres and synthesis and atomic data. You know, a lot of the groups that have been producing the 1D stellar atmospheres have been doing it for a long time. Their codes have a long heritage, but perhaps are not written in the most modern and efficient framework. And you know, I wonder whether the community should consider some path towards what I call your public atmospheres infrastructure. One thing that, you know, we've come up with is it is true that the abundances in atmospheres, deviations from standard abundance ratios can produce differences in the final derived abundances. So, you know, the idea of some kind of infrastructure that allows fully consistent atmospheres and synthesis is something I think would behoove the community to consider. Moving on to abundances, it's challenging. In particular, it's challenging Apogee, I think, maybe more so than some of the other surveys, works across a wide range of stellar parameter space, from low surface gravity cool giants down to high surface gravity cool dwarfs and warm dwarfs in between. And it's hard to get consistent abundances across broad regions of stellar parameter space. So people should be aware of that when they're trying to do science and potentially, you know, if you're trying to do the most accurate stuff, you may need to consider restricting yourself to limited regions of parameter space. And how big is this effect? That's what I'm trying to show here. So in M67, under the assumption that the abundances are homogeneous, this is along the giant branch. You can see there is some, in this case, magnesium abundance, some variation of magnesium abundance along the giant branch at the level of a few hundredths, not a huge effect. As we go into the dwarfs, things get worse. There may be, around the turnoff, there may be physical effects of diffusion, but in cooler dwarfs, there should be less of that. And we see that in cooler dwarfs, there can be deviations as much as a few tenths of a dex in abundance. And this in this region around 4,000, 4,200 degrees is where the lines are very strong. And this may point to some issues in the line lists, in particular having to do with broadening parameters. That's just a hypothesis. And this is seen across here is the same result in the Hyades, a big dip in magnesium abundances at this temperature where the lines are very strong. And things really get challenging as one goes below 3,500K, just that metallicity at all. Here's metallicity in the Hyades, which in the Apogee analysis is coming out significantly low for the coolest stars. It's not that the information isn't there. Katya Kuna and some of her collaborators have done work on M-dwarfs and are able to get consistent abundances, but it's challenging to do it in the industrial framework. So cool stars is hard. I don't have any plots here, but as you go to the coolest temperatures, molecules and working with a grid of atmospheres may present the challenge because there's rapid changes in atmospheric structures as one approaches carbon to oxygen equals one. So this kind of factors back into this idea of could we have some more flexible way of generating atmospheres and doing synthesis such that we could work in regions where things are changing fast. Another maybe lesson to be learned something to consider for the future is, you know, in most cases, the atomic data is not known sufficiently accurately from the lab. So Apogee has taken the approach, Matt Schoen's on the call, so he can talk about this, of doing so-called astrophysical GF values. But Apogee has done that based on two stars only, the Sun and Arcturus, which certainly don't, you know, cover the entire HR diagram. And so I wonder whether it would be important to try to broaden astrophysical GF values to a larger range of benchmark stars, or perhaps to push harder, and I know there's work being done on this, in clusters where one, the problem with benchmark stars is, although you may know what the stellar parameters are pretty accurately, you don't always know what the abundances are accurately. You have to depend on something else. And at least in clusters, you can make the assumption, there are some regions where it's not accurate, of uniform abundances, and whether you could tune line parameters to produce uniform abundances across clusters, I think would be a worthwhile effort. And so here's the pointed towards another, you know, potential community effort, a comprehensive optical near infrared line list. I was kind of amazed, you know, coming to spectroscopy 10 years ago, even in the optical, that there's not just a line list, that everyone has their own line list. And the spectroscopy experts will tell me why that is, but it seems like it's something that we could strive for. And again, in abundances as well as in parameters, we have this question of to calibrate or not to calibrate. When you see non-uniformities, do you present them that way as a survey, or do you try to homogenize them and then present them? So again, just kind of reporting some of the big questions that have come up in Apogee. Let's go on for a little bit. Multiple analyses. As you change the techniques, you get different answers. So here, for example, for the first time in data release 17, Apogee is presenting results from multiple different analysis techniques, or at least different input physics. So our default data release is using a synthetic grid created with the SynSpec code. And here's the gravity, the same gravity plot that I showed before. Just for comparison, here's the results using a different stellar synthesis code. With the same stellar atmospheres, and you could see that you end up getting different results for surface gravities, and these then percolate down to small differences, not large differences, in stellar abundances. So the philosophy that Apogee has taken before data release 17 was just to do one analysis and not to complicate things. And in general, we've said, hey, we're not going to pay too much attention to how things come out. We're going to try to put the best physics in, and then they come out the way they come out. And that is not always very satisfying for users, because sometimes you change something that should make things better and it makes some things worse. And so kind of confronting how to deal with having multiple analysis, I think is another topic for discussion. And this sort of thing is frustrating for users, because the results change under their feet, you know, with different data releases. Again, I don't want to make this sound worse than it is. The changes are generally small. But you know, things do move around, and if you're working at high precision level, then it can make a difference. And something I think is interesting that we've run into with the Sloan data management is sort of the people that are managing the data releases for Sloan are very concerned about not making things too complicated for potential users, which I think is something that I don't share that opinion. So for example, we have to be very important about saying there is one primary data release, and then there is some supplemental analyses, rather than just saying, hey, the situation is complicated and you should be aware of that, and you should do your analysis with multiple different analyses and see whether it makes a difference. And so, you know, kind of, you know, educating the community as to the realities of things is, again, I think worth, you know, worth some discussion. Given the fact that the detailed results change with different techniques, you know, it's a nice idea to talk about cross-survey, using different surveys to complement each other, but you have to be careful that even for the same stars, different surveys with different analysis techniques may give different results. And there's been, I think, increasing work recently on survey homogenization using machine learning tools to bring things onto the same scale. And I think that's valuable, but you have to be careful of the homogenization depends on the overlap of the different samples. And if you then want to extend outside that overlap region, then it may be more challenging to combine different surveys. All right, moving ahead quickly, since I don't want to take too long here. Lessons learned on data. Data reduction analysis is important. I think in the Apogee case, and I suspect on most survey cases, there's always improvements that can be made. And this was highlighted for me by a mistake that I recently discovered that I made, fortunately caught before the release of data release 17, which is I analyzed a few stars using a slightly incorrect line spread function. So here's the orange histogram is the difference in using the correct line spread function and the not quite correct one. And you can see it's a small effect, but at level of a few hundredths, these things matter. So if you care at that precision, I think there's improvements to be made. And fixing my mistake is still only an approximation towards handling the line spread function. And so I suspect there's future work can be done there. And I think a challenge for surveys is working on improving the analysis, and this I think both true on the data and on the spectroscopic analysis, depends on people using the data and turning up issues. And the problem I think we run into is people don't want to use the data until you say it's final. And so there's this kind of impossible back and forth of how do you ever converge towards the best results, because people don't want to use results until they're final results. And people who are working on producing the results say you need to use the results so we can make improvements. Finally, talking about project management people, personnel, lessons learned. I think it's clear that the technical work on doing analysis is important. I find it very interesting, but we seem to have a little bit of a hard time finding lots of interested people to work on these technical problems. And I'm not sure why that is, whether other people don't find them interesting, whether people are intimidated by the level of the analysis and the breadth. I mean, there's a lot of different things to learn about. Perhaps by a perceived lack of reward by the community for doing technical work. And I think an interesting question is who are the ideal people to do this technical work? Students, postdocs, faculty, staff? Traditionally, kind of technical work has been put down towards more junior personnel, but that kind of work may not be junior personnel's best path towards getting rewarded and getting jobs. And in many cases, they may not have the level of experience that maybe is best brought to bear on the problem. So I've actually thought that senior people maybe are the best people to do technical work. They're in stable jobs. They don't have to worry so much. And so that's what I've been doing. But of course, senior people have the problem, especially in the US, that there's lots of other things that they do, and it's hard to dedicate effort. So I think this is an interesting thing to talk about, how to motivate and reward technical work. And this maybe is tied up with data release and proprietary data. Typically in Sloan, in Apogee, we've worked on analysis right up until the time that the data become public. So the people that are doing the technical work don't actually have a set, a proprietary time for themselves to work on the data before other people have it. I'm not sure how big of a problem other people feel. That's a bigger problem maybe than I do. I think a problem is at some level it's an internal self deadline time management problem, because we could just decide not to work on the data up to the data release and preserve the time to work on the data before it becomes priority. But then you just get tied up in this thing of, but it's not the best analysis, but it's never the best analysis is always the problem with deadlines. I think we could probably do a little bit better job to minimize what I called survey parochialism and sharing results and tech analysis techniques between the different surveys. And I think I've perceived, and this is kind of maybe a personal thing, and I think it's hard to incorporate expertise in analysis, people who really know a lot about spectroscopy, some of them were on this call, with industrial implementation, right? And doing it for, the way that you did it by hand is not practical on scales of a million stars. But you don't want to say we have to do it on a million stars, so we're going to throw out all the experience of people doing spectroscopy. So that's mostly what I have. Just wanted to, in the name of honoring people who put in technical work, just finish this by saying, in Apogee, the effort depended on a lot of people and just a few people to call out here. The Vision Scientific for doing it from Steve Majewski and group at University of Virginia, the development of an instrument critical, for these projects, the development of data reduction software. And I won't read everybody's names, but at least they're up here on the screen to because for their well-deserved credit. And this list of people is not at all complete. There are a lot of people that have put effort into this. So I will leave this. I almost stayed in 20 minutes with some possible discussion items. Then we'll finish here and open it up for any discussion. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much, John. So this is really illuminating, because I suspect the next talk will be pretty relevant as well. So may I suggest that we move to the next talk before coming back to the question?
In that case, I'll stop sharing my screen.
Then Monica. So I leave the stage to Monica for now.
Okay. Thank you, Hyun-sen, for asking me to give this talk. I just want to say at the outset that unlike most of you on this call who are actually experts on stellar spectroscopy, I'm not. I am pretty much a newcomer to this game. I'm mainly a galactic dynamicist, and my interest in stellar spectroscopy has really been because you can get velocities of stars and therefore learn something about dynamics from that. But I happen to be currently the co-chair of the Milky Way Working Group in DESI. So I'm trying to learn what I can about spectroscopy. And so I will tell you what I know, but I think that there are other people on the call, like Hyun-sen and Ting Li, who know more than I do about DESI. But I will just give you my update. So for those who don't know, DESI is a multi-object spectrograph with 5,000 fibers on the 4-meter Mayall telescope. The fibers broadly feed 10 broadband spectrographs with three arms each. There's a really broad wavelength coverage, continuous wavelength coverage, and the resolution varies from about 2,000 in the ultraviolet to 5,000 in the near infrared. This is the sort of, this diagram shows you the current structure. The 10 spectrographs are in a separate, in a Kude room, thermally controlled. The 5,000 fibers basically travel in bundles down to the spectrograph room. This is what the focal plane looks like. It consists, the field of view is 3 degrees in diameter. It consists of 10 petals. Each petal consists of 500 robotic fibers. And these fibers have two rotational axes, which allow them to move within what's called a patrol diameter of about 2 millimeters. And the entire focal plane can be reconfigured within about 3 to 5 minutes. And so this is roughly what DESI looks like. This was the first petal that was assembled. The fibers were built at University of Michigan and assembled at LBL. So DESI is mainly a dark energy survey. That is its primary goal, to understand dark energy by baryonic acoustic oscillations and redshift distortions. So it's going to get millions of quasars, emission light galaxies, luminous red galaxies, and the bright galaxies within about redshift of 0.4. The bright galaxies survey, which of course takes place in bright time, will share the focal plane with the Milky Way survey. And the Milky Way survey will get 5 million stars in what's called the main survey. And we expect to get an additional up to 12 million stars during the BRCA program, which will be during twilight, poor weather, and extremely bright conditions. So the commissioning and survey validation took place between November of 2019 and May of 2021. And the main survey started on May 15th of this year. And it is expected to get a total of over 50 million spectra over the five-year goal. And Yuan Sen asked me to talk about DESI-2. It's still very much in the planning phase. And it is expected that the instrument will be well understood, the spectral reductions will be well understood. And the first part, there will be overlap with the first part of the LSST imaging releases. But at present, there is really not a clear model for how operations will be funded or who will participate. And that is still something that's being explored. So very quickly, let me just tell you about the science goals for the Milky Way survey. The main science goals which I'm interested in specifically are understanding the dark matter distribution in the Milky Way and local group using stellar tracers. One of the things that's become interesting in the last decade or so is the understanding that the Large Magellanic Cloud is a significant perturbation to the dark matter halo of the Milky Way. So we would like, since it's a fairly large field of view, we'd like to be able to measure the wake of the Milky Way. We can expect to get some spectra for dwarf galaxies, although not at the very centers, but look at tidal features in the peripheries, dwarf galaxies and globular clusters. And we also expect to be able to get during some secondary programs, although these are not the part of the main survey, spectra of the halos of halo stars, luminous red giants in M33 and M31. The large field of view, as you can see, this is just one petal of the DESI instrument, and M33, the disk fits comfortably on this one petal. We'll also get some amount of data for thick disk and some thin disk stars, and numerous variable stars. There are lots of rare objects, white dwarfs. We expect to get between 70,000 and 100,000 white dwarfs with G less than 20. They are high priority flux standards, and they have the highest priority of all targets, but we'll also get other rare objects. The stellar halo is of interest because it encodes the accretion history of the Milky Way and is, you can get kinematics of things like tidal streams, gives you properties of both the dark matter halo of the Milky Way as a whole, as well as allows you to set constraints on properties of dark matter substructure, such as has been illustrated with these observations of the GD1 stream. This is observations from the from Gaia. Sort of these are Gaia data, and you can see that this is the thin GD1 stream, and it shows a number of features which simulations suggest. Simulations by Bonatta et al. Suggest could be produced by the impact with dark substructure. To be able to confirm these kinds of models, one needs line of sight velocities. And so one of the things that we have already started doing is taking measurements of radial velocities for stars in the GD1 stream. And in survey validation, we already have something like 3 times as many radial velocities than have been previously obtained. I think I'm going to skip this, but the other area that we're interested in, because DESI is a large field survey, which will get, I'll show you the footprint in a moment, which will get radio velocities for halo field stars, is trying to measure this dark matter wake induced by the LMC. And so if the LMC is, if this track shows what might be the LMC orbit, you expect a dark matter wake behind it. And because it's massive enough, the Milky Way is, has a collective, has a reflex motion towards the LMC, which results in a collective response. And as shown by Garavito-Camargo, you would expect to see a difference in the velocities of halo stars, field halo stars in the northern and southern hemispheres. And there's been some attempt to measure this with LAMOS data and suggest that there is already a signal, but we would need to be able to get large numbers of stars out to much larger distances to be able to confirm this. So this is roughly what the DESI, the main DESI footprint for the cosmological survey is. There are lots of different substructure within this footprint. This purple shows the Sagittarius stream. This is the GD1 stream, this is the Orphan stream, the Hercules Aquila cloud, and the Palomar 5. And the red stars are various globular, are various dwarf galaxies, and the blue triangles are various globular clusters. So the footprint itself is, the targets are selected from the legacy surveys, which had these deep GR and Z band observations of 4,000 square degrees, plus several other surveys, and combined with the some WISE observations. So these are the surveys used for target selection. DESI is the Milky Way survey is going to use a fairly simple selection function, and to make modeling as easy as possible. And so this is basically, there's going to be a main blue and the main red in G minus R and R space. And then there is also going to be a proper motion cut for stars which are redder than G minus R of 0.7 in order to exclude nearby high proper motion dwarfs. We will limit the main broad survey will be lower priority than the main red and main blue. in addition, this will give us, this is that same plot, but this comparing with some Galaxia mocks, you see that the thick disk is going to be basically this region here. So we'll get some thick disk stars, we'll get some thin disk stars. These are the sort of nearby thin disk stars, and a fair number of hopefully a fair number of halo stars. We expect to get. So this is just a distribution of the targets available to the DESI within the DESI footprint, and these are the different classes of targets that we expect to be able to obtain. So the survey validation phase enabled us to get some idea of how well the spectra are able to get radio velocities. And so this plot, which actually contains data from only up to March of 2021, shows the log of the radio velocity error as a color scale on this color magnitude diagram. And this is a 1 kilometer a second, this curve, and this is 10 kilometer a second error. And so most of the stars that we hope to target are going to have radial velocities better than 10 kilometers a second. This was, the standard effective exposure time is expected to be about 180 seconds. The survey validation phase also, these radial velocities are obtained with Sergei Karpusov's RV spec code. The spectroscopic pipeline, well, the abundances are obtained using Ferre, which was, was written by Carlos Allende Pietro, whom I'm sure many of you know. He was very much part of Sloan and Apogee. And we see that they give about 0.2 dex precision. Currently, there's an offset that we're trying to understand. And these are a nearby, these are all nearby objects, most of them. This is something that's in progress. We're trying to better understand the nature of, the errors in the spectra. So just moving on very quickly, as I, since Yuan Sen asked me to say something about DESI 2, it's intended to be a five-year program extending from 2026 to 2030. Again, mostly doing cosmology, but there is a considerable scope for dark matter astrophysics and stellar spectroscopy in the Milky Way and local group out to much larger distances. So there's no collaboration has yet been formed, but this is in the process of being discussed. The Mayol telescope is, of course, a property of NSF, and the instrument, DESI instrument, is under DOE. So possibly any future collaboration will involve these agencies. So some of the things that we could do, of course, are continue our study of dark matter astrophysics, but we also hope to be able to do a more detailed Milky Way plane survey, which the Milky Way plane is, of course, excluded largely from the DESI survey because because the focus is on high redshift on cosmology. In order to be able to go out further, say to an R of 22, it is estimated that one would need exposure times of about between 1 and 3 hours to get signal to noise adequate signal to noise of 10 or 4 to get 1 to 3 kilometers a second radial velocity precision. So these are the sort of, this is just a table showing the kinds of targets that one might be able to access within, if you go down to R of 22, BHB and RR Lyrae, of course, K-giants, Milky Way, turnoff stars, out to much larger distances than we can currently obtain. So, So I guess the main interest is that the overlap with LSST will enable us to eliminate because within a few years, using Gaia as a baseline, LSST will be able to give us 0.2 milliarc second proper motion for nearby stars, which we can then exclude if we want to get out to larger distances. So I think that the sort of straw person DESI design DESI 2 design is currently, you know, of course, it's this is just speculation, but it might be something like 100,000 square degrees in total, 2-hour exposure time per target, with, you know, maybe special tiles for dwarfs and halo objects, and signal to noise of 20 for stars out to 19th magnitude, 22. And so, you know, for at least some large fraction of the stars, one can get abundances and age measurements. Of course, Yuan Sen is an expert on getting these from low resolution spectroscopy. So we are hoping that he will be able to help with those aspects. And so, yeah, so that's about all I think that's all I have to say. I'm not sure that this is what you were hoping to hear, but, and I'm sorry if I went over, but.
Oh, this is great. Thank you so much for both speakers. So now we will open the floor for discussion. So maybe I will start by asking, of course, like Sloan and Desi are looking at like a very like different part of the parameter space. So do you think if like beside DESI 2 is mostly a succession of like DESI by going deeper. So is there any like parameter space that you think is currently like lacking in the landscape of like multi-object spectrograph?
I think we're still really lacking even more time series than we have. Oh, and sorry.
Go ahead.
Anyway, that was my thought. There is always a need for more time series, both for variability in spectral features and for RV variability.
Yeah, but that is what the Sloan 5 will fill in, right?
I mean, limitedly, right? I mean, we're going to get a bunch, but we're not going to get a million stars with orbits, right?
that's actually quite an interesting one. So, do people have more?
And I don't know if we need a million stars with orbits, and I don't know if we put together Gaia plus astrometry, or Gaia plus RV, but I do know that we are doing a much better job of getting individual spectra for stars than we are for getting all of their kinematics.
Right. And I saw Xiangqi has a question.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. And about DESI, I'm curious about like, is there any current plan for like public release or is there any current tentative schedule for that?
The survey validation data. Basically data that was taken up to July of 2021 is currently being processed in what's called the Fuji data release, and it is. It hasn't yet been released internally, but it's expected to be released to within the collaboration in January. And then in June of 2022, June or July of 2022, the plan is to release it to make a public release. And so that already has something like for stars, it already has something like 800,000 unique spectra. Spectra of 800,000 stars. So that's already a lot. I mean, it's very limited, regions of the sky, but that's, and it, you know, the regions were as, because it were really designed to test mostly cosmology, but yeah, this will be released fairly soon. And then subsequently there will be, I think, annual data releases.
Matt?
So, Monica, I was wondering about what the visit schedule looks like. Is it generally just one visit per field? Because Apogee found that multiple visits had a lot of use for both finding binarity, which impacts your dark matter calculations, but also in the abundance determinations, a lot of our error analysis comes from repeat visits.
Yeah. So unfortunately, I think only a small fraction of the targets will have two or more visits. And I think that's something like 11% or so, you know, I don't know, 15% of targets will have more than one visit. So I agree with you. It would be really good to have multiple visits, but I don't think that's currently the prioritization of targets is to actually get a new target first before doing a repeat observation, unless a star which has previously been observed is the only option available to a fiber.
So the other question was for John. John, for the work that suggests that that you only need a few elements to sort of determine the overall composition, that seems to be a big feature for some of the results for Apogee, but doesn't that also go against some of the other conclusions that are that, you know, find different leanings towards the star formation and the high mass versus low mass, you know, magnesium versus calcium differences? So how do you kind of square those two different results?
I'm not sure I know what you're talking about for the magnesium to calcium.
Like Sagittarius, Sten's work that suggests that you might have leave off the high mass component.
I think that's where I said things are a little bit open, because the relations that, you know, that do the predictions are in a different regime in surface gravity than, say, in the dwarf spheroidals. And so we're not quite sure yet, I think, whether those point to significant differences or not. At least that's my thought.
Okay.
And Paula?
Yeah, I want to comment on John's comment about who should be doing the technical work. I agree that there is little reward, but then, and somehow it makes sense if most senior people do it because they know how to do it, but also, like, how are you going to train a new generation into the business when actually what they have to do is to really understand and be able to analyze this kind of data, which is the new data, because it is very difficult for a junior person also just to work independently on a couple of stars that they can observe individually and analyze individually. So somehow that I also have the impression that these data releases and all these huge campaigns for getting all these huge data sets are moving so fast that there is even very little time for junior people to learn. And, I think that it's interesting to discuss how do we want to handle that part. I mean, the students need to learn this and they have to make the mistakes and they need time and we have to give them that somehow.
Yeah, I agree. It's a challenge, but maybe other people have something they want to say.
Yeah, I actually like the idea they talk about the distinction between the proprietary, like versus like more openness. Of course, Apogee, Gala, and Gaia ESO are, like, in my opinion, the three tiers. They take like quite a different like approach in terms of how much like a proprietary data they want to keep, right? And they also, you know, in turn like decide how many people are involved in individual of this and sort of the scientific like outcome. So Apogee, of course, is a more extreme version where you are more open than the other one. So do you still think it's the right strategy, I guess? In light of, you know, the last 10 years?
I think public data release is an important thing and a valuable thing.
And Sangshi has a question.
Oh, no, so I actually just want to like add some more comments about like what Paula said. So yeah, so last year I was also a applicant for postdoc, and at that time I also saw a position for like a survey for more pipeline work, but like I'm just like want to share my perspective from like the point of view of an applicant. That at that time I was actually very interested in that data set particularly, but the problem that in the main concern I have is that because the postdoc period is so short, so it's just a lot of concern about how much you can do for your other science work, and therefore that's one of the reasons that I didn't apply for that particular job. But I think that's just a different opinion or comments. Yeah.
I mean, so that's a choice you made. Do that. I mean, I don't know whether it's a false choice. Maybe you do.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Just share like kind of like a different perspective. But yeah, I'm still not sure if that's a good good decision. But yeah, that's just how the applicant may see the situation.
So we are almost at the hour. I just want to, so Ting has a question.
Well, I do have a question to John, but I want to just make a quick comment on what Xinqin just said. So I would say like a lot of these kind of like, because I work a lot with like a dark energy kind of community that a lot is led by like national labs, like Berkeley for DESI, Fermilab for DES. So I feel like in this cosmology community, because they kind of come from the high energy community, they have a lot of the 5-year postdoc, and it's very common in that community to have a 5-year and or even longer, because they feel like for this kind of development infrastructure and stuff, it takes a lot of time to doing all of those. And a 3-year is kind of too short, and it's kind of not enough for career development. And usually they get a prestigious, like national lab fellow. And then they can also, like, instead of doing 2-3 year postdoc, like what astronomers do, they do 1-term 5-year postdoc and then move on to the next position, either like a staff in a lab or a faculty at a university. So that's, I think, also something should be considered. I actually do have a question for John, because I feel like we are hearing a talk about the Apogee and like the survey had in the past, and also heard that the DESI for the future. I'm curious, like, John, if I ask you to name one thing that you will do in a different way for Apogee in terms of either development of like technician part or management, either like what that would be, like maybe that's something we can learn for DESI or Weave or Foremost or Sloan 5. I would be interested to know what that most thing you can think of.
I said I should have listened to Matt Chatrone more. No. But no, I mean, seriously, I think, you know, I think learning more about fundamental spectroscopy before just plugging away at doing industrial analysis, recognizing all the different contributions and somehow sharing that knowledge before moving ahead. I don't know.
Do you mean we need to understand the stellar model better before we actually deal with data?
Well, I mean, you have to do them at the same time, but sure. Yeah. I don't know, what does Matt think? Or he left.
but since we are at the hour, but it's a very interesting discussion. I'm pretty sure this discussion will continue. And this recording, of course, will be useful for many years to come. And thank you, John and Monica, for making the time for sharing your thought. And thank you so much for coming. So we will see you next semester.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.